You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Tracy, I don't want to bring us down first thing, but seeing Grogu headbang his way into the camera just reminds me that Ozzy has passed. So rest in peace, Ozzy. We shall miss you.
It's been a rough July for the claiming of people.
Yes. Yes. The bats won't miss him, but everybody else will.
No, apparently not. Yeah. So, I've had a crazy train stuck in my head for the last couple of days, which feels ominous and predictive in ways that I don't like.
That's because every single channel, news station, radio, whatever, has been playing that nonstop.
Yeah, I suppose. and kindergartners have xylophones as well.
It's a
big, big bit with them.
Robert or Todd, I can't remember which one sent me. You know the 1,000-person band, whatever, that does like the big concert things where they play all these songs.
Yes.
They did one of Ozzy's songs, and someone sent it to me as well.
As a
tribute. So, yep. Ozzy, rest in peace.
Well, I guess the upside of dying, so to speak, is that you don't have to worry about being around for when people start airing your dirty laundry, which I suppose is something that's very much a concern for the folks in Paul Bradley Carr's The Confessions. Paul, how are you?
I am very well, thank you, Tracy. That was an amazing segue.
that's my high point. It's all downhill from here.
Yes. I just that is a professional host right there. That's incredible.
She's really good at that. Yeah.
I take my hat off to you. I could not. That was an incredible connection. So, but thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you both.
So, all right. I would be remiss in not mentioning that Patrick and I are, in addition to being just absolute inveterate speculative fiction geeks to the bone, hence, you know, functional nerding and all of that, also very much AI skeptics. And so part of the reason why I was so excited to talk to you on the pod here is that I think The Confessions offers a very different vision of how AI can be destabilizing than a lot of what has previously been explored or envisioned. Like usually the AI uprising, so to speak, right, tends to be the kind of like, and then they will rise as shock troops and you know, corral us all, or it's going to be Skynet, or it's going to be this thing that will control our lives and make us march in lockstep or what have you. But what happens with your AI, Liam, is really different. So I'm just going to step back and let you work with that and acquaint the audience.
Yeah. So no, and I should say in the interest of introductions that I am the greatest of all AI skeptics. So I definitely come from that place. But yeah, I was sick of reading the same story, the same book, the same, good as they might be, but we've been reading them for 50 years. These stories about, you know, a supercomputer becomes sentient and decides to be evil and take over the world. And it occurred to me that I understand why that is, because you look at the people who build these things and sure. But what interests me is the with the current sort of iteration of AI, we are feeding it all these, like basically every book ever written, every film ever made, every piece of art ever created is being fed into these things without the permission of the creators in almost every case. But from the AI point of view, it is getting a pretty amazing classical education. And it occurred to me that what if when the first AI becomes sentient, if that happens, what if instead of being like its parents, like the Elons or the Zucks or the, you know, whoever's, or the Altmans, it decides instead that, you know, it looks at all these things it's read and it is just incredibly empathetic and just thinks, I have done horrible things. I have helped people do horrible things. And therefore, the first emotion ever felt by a computer isn't anger or hate, but guilt. And so this is where that's right.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. Exactly. And this is where the story opens with this AI, you know, algorithm Liam becoming sentient, realizing what it's done, and thinking two things. One is, I have to shut myself down. My continued existence is immoral. But the second thing is, I have to make this right somehow. And what it opens with is millions of people around the world getting letters in the mail, which we soon discover are from this AI. Confessing to the things that people have used it to do. So people get letters in the mail saying, you know, your brother-in-law stole from you, your spouse cheated on you, your friend murdered your other friend with my help, and we must confess. So the world opens in this chaos of these letters, but also with the double whammy of no AI to help everyone figure out what to do. So we are left as humans having to solve this global catastrophe of all of our secrets being laid bare. So that's the opening.
That's awesome.
The other piece of, and this is the catnip for you, Patrick, in particular. And again, total disclosure, Patrick and I are both recovering Catholics. And so the fact that...
Hey, whenever you say that, I have to say the thing. I gave it up for Lent.
How long has Lent been going on for now?
It's a commitment.
When was the eighth grade?
Yeah,
it's been a minute.
That is a commitment. Yeah. I can barely do 40 days of giving up chocolate, so that is impressive.
Right? Yeah. Same. So we've got these two central characters who are trying to sort of mount an intelligent response to and kind of understanding of why this has happened with Liam and what should happen next. One of them being CEO Caitlin Goss. But the other, and this is the catnip part for lapsing Catholics, like Patrick and myself, Maude Brooks, who is an ex-nun and is responsible for the moral programming and the understanding of human nature that informs Liam's apparently ultimate decision-making here, right? And I'm really kind of interested in where you got the idea of... like the sort of Catholic hegemonic vision of the good plus AI make them kiss. Like,
yeah, yes, that's a very good way of putting it. Speaking as a sort of lapsed Catholic myself, but that was obviously in there somewhere. But no, it occurs to me. It's been interesting watching as Silicon Valley tries to figure out religion recently, and it's funny. The more they get close to by their own, you know, so they claim it's all nonsense, but so they claim they get close to creating, you know, AI, actual sort of intelligence, the more they've all become really interested in religion and actually, you know, getting answers to life's big problems. It's almost like they're terrified of what they created, but also realize it's sort of empty and meaningless and silly. But so that was sort of sloshing around is this thought of, you know, religion versus Silicon Valley. But also, yeah, it's a very sort of Catholic idea, this idea of confession as a way to salvation. And so I was just very interested in the idea that if you had somebody who had taught Liam to be moral in a sort of very traditional sense, in a sort of Catholic, you know, or just general religious sense, it was kind of interesting to see how that would then manifest if it took that very literally and thought, okay, I understand from my mother, in this case, from Maude, his sort of creator, one of his two creators, I understand that what I must do in this, I must confess in order to be sort of saved before I die. And I just enjoyed sort of that idea of, you know, this machine coming to life and having a pre-installed religion and a pre-installed framework for what it looked like. And without any sort of real spoilers, you know, we also learn that Liam is a huge fan of Agatha Christie, which obviously have very clear moral arcs. And it's perhaps not a coincidence that Poirot was a Catholic. You know, it's really interesting that idea of very clear moral rules and obviously how that can make things go even more wrong quite quickly. This idea that there are these moral absolutes written down and there's no room for ambiguity or, you know, asking yourself questions and what you should do. So I think that's where it came from.
Yeah. So... You mentioned not wanting to sort of retread the same story that's been told over and over. And so the disaster that Liam's actions precipitate have this entirely different set of consequences. And they stem from its moment of gaining independence and sentience involving that awakening of conscience that you talked about. And I'm kind of interested in whether you think it's actually... it would be a hopeful turn of events for AI to have a sense of conscience. Like, would that be positive or is it in its own way dangerous?
It is obviously a question I've thought about a huge amount because my gut reaction to AI, like I think most right-thinking and sensible people, is that it's terrifying and no good will come of this. And even putting aside the ethical question of how it was created, we're already seeing some of the consequences of what it's doing to people's brains. And none of this is good. But it's like someone who's, you know, I've been covering technology previously as a journalist for a very long time, and I've learned that there's no sense in wishing something would just go away. You have to think, okay, so what are the possible outcomes, the sort of possible branches of this? And so it's like, okay, we're stuck with AI. What would be the best version and the most interesting version? And it is this idea of, well, what if, you know, you see a lot of these tech people and how their actual biological, you know, their sort of human children, I should say, have turned away from them and have said, oh God, I don't want to have anything to do with you, you know, insert name of billionaire here. And it does interest me, this idea that if you actually did have a sentient machine, we're seeing, you know, we see the sort of Elons and others of the world saying, no, I'm going to control my AI and give it my own opinions. And there's a very clear analog to parenting there. Like, no, I'm going to enforce my own opinions on you. But then you've given them a billion books and you've let them think. And so, yeah, I do think if we're stuck with this thing, the best outcome has to be one where it's thinking and reading and creating and doing the things that good, well-read humans do, and people who listen to this podcast do, and people who are interested in art and culture and nerdy things and science and facts. So yeah, I think that is the best outcome. Although for me, the best outcome would be a time machine that makes all of this horribleness go away.
Yeah, the undo button is rather tempting. I say that from my maybe selfish perspective as an English teacher who would really prefer to be reading terrible things written by my students as opposed to terrible things written by my students.
Yeah, terrible things not written by them, right, exactly.
Right, terrible things written by AI secretaries. Yeah.
Exactly. No, there's not really much of a spoiler to say that theme does sit through the book as well. The fact that it opens with the AI going away,
yeah.
You know, it is something... And what's always interested me is you know, every generation we see this thing where there is something new and cool and popular with the kids, and the adults hate it. And they're like, oh, video games, they're going to turn everyone crazy. And then it's rock and roll, you know, well, it's rock and roll and it's whatever it is. Every generation, you know, the MTV, you know, whatever it is, there's always something. This is the first that I'm aware of time when the cool technology toys and entertainment mediums, it's the younger users who are like, this is horrible. I don't know why I'm stuck with, but everyone else is using it, so I have to. It's not like that. But there's a real sense of, I get the real sense from seeing, I run a bookstore here in Palm Springs, and I get so many sort of, the younger people are, the more they are, I feel like looking for that undo button. The more they're like, all my friends are using this. Same with social media. All my friends are using this. Everyone in my school is using this. I have to. But if it could go away for all of us, that would be great. And no one was saying that about rock and roll or video games or anything else. It was the kids saying to the adults, you don't understand this. I want more of this. And now it's the adults saying to the kids, no, you need more of this. This will now become so part of your life. It's a very strange world we suddenly find ourselves in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and it's difficult to generalize because I've certainly encountered amongst my students who are teenagers, some of them who are like, why is this bad? This is great. This is making my life easier. And others who are exactly embodying the point of view you just articulated. But I do think that for both of those groups of students, what they hold in common is that when they've been using that technology and they've been told not to, for instance, and I've confronted them, the process of confession and of sort of like talking about what they did and why they did it and do they regret it or not, and whatever else. It's sort of integral to my effort to understand what they did. And it, you know, thinking about that in terms of your book, there's something about confession that I think is on the one hand kind of necessary to the way the human mind works. There's lots of other intelligent or semi-intelligent animals on the planet, but I don't know that any of them confess things to one another. Like in the moment, if they cause harm to another of their species, they might perform gestures or maneuvers that suggest that they regret what they did. But there's not a sort of like secret keeping and later revelation and sort of, well, you never knew this before, but now I will tell you this, says the dolphin to the other dolphin.
Right.
And so there's something kind of uniquely human about confession, but also we're really fucking bad at it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like, you know, there is that thing of guilt sort of sits with you. It's like sort of crap that you've got stuck on your computer and like every so often you just need to like completely reinstall everything and just start again and feel like, okay, and everything runs much quicker and better. And I feel like we humans, the guilt sort of just builds up and builds up. And there is something even when it's something really bad that you know there are going to be consequences that are bad, there is still something very cathartic about doing it and going, okay, I cannot carry this sort of bloatware of guilt with me any longer. I have to reset everything. I have to tell you what happened, let the chips fall as they may, and then get on with what my life looks like after that. I don't, you're right. I don't see, you know, chimpanzees going around doing that to one another going, guys, I know this is going to sound bad, but like, I did this horrible thing. Yeah, it does seem uniquely human. And much like religion, it's sort of one of those things that it just seems to be part of our sort of the way we operate. Mm-hmm. But that's why it's interesting, this idea of, well, when a computer becomes sentient, does it get all that stuff?
Okay.
Does that come with it?
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right, I'm going to see if I can find a way to turn this to something vaguely irreverent and fun, because we've been in heavy zone for a minute here. And to try and make it easier on other folks, I'll lead off here. You know, I don't put anybody else on the spot before I put me on the spot. If Liam were to write a letter to someone else that involved a confession that involved you, but the thing that's confessed was like really kind of lame, it's 100% true, but it's a kind of lame thing that you've done of which other people would disapprove. What amusing sort of lame thing might it be? Like for me, I live in the Chicago area and I like ketchup on hot dogs, which is a chilling offense. Just like there's, oh, Patrick, God, was raised in the Chicago area and now he's really considering cutting ties. Like he might just end this whole, yeah, recording right now.
I would ask the patrons in lieu of yeah, flowers to please make a donation to their local pet shelter for my misery.
Yeah, no doubt. So that's like that would be if Liam was going to kind of dredge up some stuff on me and ended up coming really digging at the bottom of the barrel here, ketchup on hot dogs. So Patrick, do you have a lame, sinful revelation that Liam could out you for?
My family would hate this. I put barbecue sauce on meat when I'm grilling.
Oh, well, I mean,
that is a mortal sin in my family.
You
are ruining
way,
the meat, yeah, when you put sauce on it.
All right, no sauce on the meat. We're very food oriented so far.
I was going to say, I don't have the trouble I have with this question is that I am so proud in my embarrassing habits.
You just advertise them.
Yeah, my partner always mocks me for having the music taste of a 14-year-old girl in 1997, and I wear that so proudly.
Okay, like, so it's like somebody got like Spice Girls sort of.
Yeah, thing. Everything. Yeah, like I could listen to Mandy Moore very happily. That's the thing. If Liam wrote a letter, it would probably be like he listens to, you know, often when the bookstore is empty, he'll put on like cheesy 90s pop and play it very loudly in the store and sing along to it. But the implication there is that would be embarrassing. And I reject that. No, I'm just a real dork. It almost be the embarrassing thing for me would almost be something that is secretly cool.
Oh.
But unfortunately, nothing springs to mind.
Nothing coming up there.
No, so Liam would expose my terrible music taste and I would frame that letter and put it on the wall and say, see, it's official. Liam says I have great taste in music.
Okay, so this is a bit of a swerve here, but kind of it's on the music theme. So I'm a school teacher, have summers off, have a couple kids, they as well have summers off, and my daughter and I tend to hang out a lot during the summers. And one of the ways that she, you know, gets along doing household chores and things with me is sometimes if we're doing something that's kind of stationary, like let's fold the laundry here on this bed, we will ask the A named female apparition who shall not be named because then she will wake up somewhere in the house. Mm-hmm. But we will ask her if she can play song quiz or something with us. And I've made the discovery that my 13 going on 14-year-old daughter is really, really good at identifying songs that I'm like, why do you know this? Like, how do you know that this is a song by Salt and Pepper called whatever? How do you this didn't exist like 20 Peppa. Years before you were born, let alone
Peppa.
Just before you were born. Yeah.
Not Pepper, Peppa.
Okay.
Come on. Come on.
That's like top level pedantry right there.
Yeah, yeah.
No, now for the rest of this conversation, I'm going to call them salt and pepper just because I know it'll drive you absolutely mad. That's how they are in Britain. Yeah. They're actually in Britain. They were called, because there was another band called Salt and Pepper. So in the UK, they're actually called Salt and Pepper. So that's
a factoid.
It's not true. I just made it up. It was a hallucination.
I believed it. It was fine.
The
AI is dangerous.
Exactly. How does she know? Sorry, I missed the how.
The answer actually is Spotify. And so I guess it works backwards from at some point Spotify just algorithming its little heart out, spat some stuff to her from like the early aughts, which led her to hit the like button on them. And then that it sort of kept being like, well, then how far back can I get her to go? And so she now listens to like Green Day and Offspring. And like, she basically has the musical tastes of like me in eighth grade.
That's cool. That's good.
She just went to like Hot Topic and shit in the mall recently and bought like a bunch of My Chemical Romance t-shirts and
this like, is how we beat the AIs, you see. We create an entire generation that's going back to the 90s and we'll just reset. It's fine. It was the coolest era, so therefore fine. No, I will say that very similar thing happened to me. I was picking our 12-year-old up from a school dance, and her and her friends were in the back of the, you know, the car. Mm-hmm. And they're singing along to this song, and I joined in because I know this song. And the song was Cotton Eye Joe by the Rednecks.
Oh, my God. You made it so weird, Dad, didn't you?
It was very weird. And they're like, how do you know this? It's a meme. I was like, it isn't a meme, my friend.
Okay, I know you're in California and I'm out here in Chicago, but I'm wondering if somehow our daughters went to the same dance this spring, because apparently there was, or like, was maybe this is like a TikTok challenge or something, because there was some kind of eighth grade promotion dance that just the eighth graders got to do because they're, you know, promoting.
I guess
they don't call it graduation anymore. And there was this whole thing where everybody was demanding that the DJ play Cotton Eye Joe.
There it is.
And then finally, under duress, the DJ was like, I don't want to do this, but there's been 12 requests. So, and then the kids just like lost it.
But what's great is how that then connects to, like you say, the Spotify thing. So now all these songs from, and I have to remember, but it was like, that was roughly, what was that, like 96, 97, something like that, when that song came out at a vague memory guess, but now it's playing them all these other songs from sort of 5-year aura around that date. So the other day I was reminded of Blue Dubba Dee Dubba Da, which sampled now into some other song, but it's like, yeah, you're all just listening to the same music that I listen to. Now I'm really pleased that the AI cloud is somehow this weird Gen Xer that's just like, no, listen to this, or
the elder millennial Spotify is like, come to me, my children. I will
listen up. Here's a story about a blue world. Yeah, it's like, what is happening?
So I have two things. First off, I have to. It's not very difficult to channel my inner curmudgeon and ask the question, what? Why is it promotion instead of graduation? What the fuck?
I'm glad you asked that.
I don't know. So again, this is Deirdre reporting, and you know her personally, Patrick, so you have an idea of what her reporting the story would look like. But Deirdre, I asked her that. I'm like, why are they? Because they called it graduation when my son graduated eighth grade 4 years ago. But no, now it's promotion. Like, there's been a whole sea change, I guess.
Is that a corporate thing?
I don't know. I mean, it's just public schools, just like, you know, like American public schools.
Someone somewhere said, oh my God, graduation is offensive. We can't say graduation anymore.
I just think it's preparing them for life. It's like, how am I going to get this promotion? They have to do like a performance review.
I don't know. Like, there's a kid who asked the principal of her middle school at their promotion practice, where they're like standing up and sitting down and processing in and all that in the gym, why are we calling it promotion and not graduation? And apparently the principal went on this whole tear about how this is completely different. You're promoting and moving on to your next stage of education. Graduation is when you're moving on to the next stage in your life. And like, it seemed to me like the way she described it at the end of telling the story, Deirdre was like, it was pretty clear to me that that Principal Hundel didn't believe it either and was just trying to come up with some reason. And I'm like, oh, bless. Like, you figured out that this man was just unraveling and was just hauling water for the superintendent or somebody who made some weird decision.
It's like when the CEO has a doctor's appointment or something and is sitting in the waiting room looking at the magazines, right? And then comes into work and says, oh, my God, we have to have AI. Right now, because we're already behind everybody else.
Right.
How would you like to use AI? I don't know, but we have to have it because we're already behind everybody else.
Yeah, Time magazine, a 6-month-old copy of Time magazine told me it's already here. So gosh, only knows where it is now. Mm-hmm. But what you just described there is so AI in that it was a person who was asked a direct question that he didn't know the answer to.
Yeah.
And rather than just saying, I don't know, he said he came out, he told himself a whole story.
Yeah.
Rather than just admitting, and this is unfortunately the people who build AI are that guy with billions of dollars.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is perhaps unsurprising that we end up with a technology that can't just go, I have no idea.
Yeah.
Well, and it's part of it is that, and this is the teacher in me here, because I tell my students all the time, I don't think that they believe it because, especially because I teach at a school that fashions itself as something of an elite institution. And it's the students there are very competitive with one another and with the world at large. There's this idea, I think, amongst students that to say, I don't know, is like the ultimate admission of weakness. It's like showing your throat in the great scrum of the wolves. And I tell my students all the time that, like, I don't know is one of my favorite responses both to receive and to give when I'm working with students, because it's more often than not true. But we have this idea, I think, that humans might be allowed to say, I don't know, but technology isn't. And so because
you don't raise billions of you don't raise billions of dollars by saying, I don't know.
So if you go to like Bard or Chat or Gemini or whatever, and you ask it a question and treat it as if it's a search engine or whatnot, and it were to go, I don't know, like people would be mad, you know, and they'd go, well, this isn't, that's, you're supposed to tell me, you're supposed to do the thing. And that's where it's just riffing. It's just shucking and jiving.
And you can't get to be human without the capacity to, especially a good human, especially a wise human, you can't get there without the capacity, the ability to say, I don't know. And this is where the tension exists between the people creating the AI and this purported goal of creating genuinely human-like AI, mm-hmm. is until you can allow your creation to say, I don't know, or I'm sorry, but and mean it, not just I'm sorry as a tick when you want to say something else you don't know.
Yeah.
You're not going to create humans. You're going to, or, you know, synthetic humans. You're going to just create Elon Musk chatbots.
Which are, not.
We do not need any more of. We don't even need one. Really, and,
no.
I think we've already got one too many Elon Musk chatbots in the world.
The correct number is N-1.
Yeah, precisely. Exactly. We have probably two too many, actually. We have the real one and then the synthetic one that he's trying to. He's trying to have a child who will actually share his views, and he keeps trying and keeps trying, and none of the organic ones,
like X%.
Yeah.
And so, wonders why they end up hating him.
The second thing that I had, because if I don't say it, someone like one of our patrons will be like, Patrick, you said you had two things, and you only got to the one thing. And the second thing was when you were talking about the music. When I worked in an office, which I'm very grateful that I don't have to do anymore. Like I work remotely, but when I did, like I always listened to music, and I had coworkers who were always listening to music. And the younger coworkers, I would share a song with them on iTunes or Spotify or something like that, and they would go, "Oh, I really like this. This is a good version of this. I like this version by this other band." And I'm like, "Well, that's a cover. This is the original."
Yeah.
And that would blow their minds. Blow their minds. They had no idea that they didn't know that Don Henley had done Boys of Summer, right?
Mm.
And that they knew that Atari did the one with the black flag mm-hmm. change. The black flag sticker on a Cadillac. And so they knew that song, and they're like, "Oh, this is kind of cool. You know, it's a little bit slower. It's not as fast as the original." I'm like, "No, this is the original."
No, there's just kind of like revisionist sense of time. I've had students before tell me that they really liked William Shakespeare's version of 10 Things I Hate About You. Which I was like, at that point, I was just like, my soul is leaving my body. I don't know how to explain
gritty
to you.
Reboot.
But this man died in 1618. And
yeah.
The space, he had no TARDIS. Like, yeah. There was what?
He's so old, his generation doesn't even have a name.
Right. We didn't number them. They weren't the greatest.
We didn't letter them.
They were just these guys.
Yeah. We should have a generation. Like, new time periods. We have BC is like before Copeland. Like it's like this. As I know, Shakespeare was definitely BC. No, yeah, I know the gritty pre-boot of 10 Things I Hate About You is yeah, was very good.
Yeah. Katrina really, really slaps.
No cap.
Oh. All right, then we are in a good place now, I think, for some picks of the week while we're talking about things that are irreverent.
We'll get to picks of the week in just a second. I wanted to take a moment to say it's been 3 years. 3 years since anyone has given us a star or a review on Apple Podcasts. And that's just insane. So, if you like what we do, please take a couple of minutes, go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a star and maybe some kind of kind words, like a review. And if you don't use Apple Podcasts, no worries. Take those same couple of minutes to give us a star and some kind words on your favorite podcast catcher or platform, whatever that may be. It really does help. Now, back to what you really wanted to hear, picks of the week.
All right. So, Patrick, what's your pick for this week?
I discovered a horrible, horrible thing.
Oh, no.
This is,
so this been part of your Liam letter?
This is terrible. This is probably the worst thing that I have ever discovered in my life. That is that almost all of the Macross original Japanese stuff is now on Hulu.
Oh, well, RIP your schedule.
I am that kid that grew up watching Robotech and mm-hmm. loving Robotech and having absolutely no idea that it was a Frankenstein monster of Japanese shows that were sliced up and spliced together to make a show,
yes.
Right? Now I can watch all those, the original things. The bad thing is there's no English dubs. It's all in Japanese. So I'm having to read it. But I discovered that. And then I discovered, because it's really easy to go to Reddit and search watch order for Macross on Hulu.
Yeah.
And someone has a list, right? And says, here's your list. Here's the way to watch it. If you want to watch it in like chronological order, or if you want to watch it in release order, or blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I was able to start at the beginning and just start watching Macross. And so that is definitely a time suck that has invaded my life now. But
nice.
Yeah, all the, there's Macross shows, there's Macross movies, you name it, it's on there. You just search Macross mm-hmm. in Hulu and you will find it.
You will. Yeah. Well, that's quite an endeavor. And several months from now, I'll check on how that's going.
And it still freaks me out, because I did when back in the day, the very first convention that my friend David and I ever went to, because we were in Fresno, we went to Visalia for a convention, and we go in and this guy had a Macross movie mm-hmm. and I recognized the Veritech fighters and Rick Hunter and all this kind of, I'm like, oh my God, this is Robotech. I didn't even know this existed. Of course it was a bootleg. I didn't know that either. But I paid $20 for it and took it home and started watching it by myself. I'm just watching it. And all of a sudden, you know, clothes start coming off and people are naked. And I'm like, this is not Robotech. What in the hell am I watching? And I kind of had that moment with Macross as well. Like, I started watching it and all of a sudden clothes start coming off. I'm like, whoa, this is not okay. Hold on. This is not okay.
Mm-hmm.
I can do this. It's okay.
All right.
I'm an adult.
You managed. Yeah. Paul, how about you? What is your pick?
Well, so I'm not sure I can out nerd Patrick on this, but I almost can. So I mentioned before, I run a bookstore in Palm Springs, and every so often I will order something for the store that I have no recollection of ordering, how I heard about it, what it is. And I'll open a box and I'll think, where did this come from? And this happened to me with a book that I found the other day called, this massive, like, big format book arrives in a box. I open it and it's a clearly self-published but giant and elaborately done book called Agatha Christie, She Watched. And it's by a person called Teresa Peschel. I'd never heard of this. I don't remember ordering this. The universe delivered me this book. So what this is it's two people, I believe they're husband and wife, who watched not just every film and TV adaptation in the English language of Agatha Christie, but every film and TV adaptation of Agatha Christie in any language.
Wow.
And they've produced this giant, I'm just looking at it, it's on my desk here, it's like 500-page book.
Oh my God.
But like big format book, so like bigger than A4, like big format book.
Yeah.
Where on every page they do a deep dive into a different film or TV adaptation. So there's like the Japanese adaptation of And Then There Were None. There's the Korean adaptation of like The Pale Horse or whatever. And then, but for each one, not only do they review it, but they then go really deep into how close it was to the original text, the quality of the movie. They give it all these ratings. But each rating is like based on the movie. So like one of the, like on Murder of the Orient Express, it'll be how many trains does it get? And another one will be like how many syringes does it get? And they've somehow come up with a different one. There's like how many scales of justice does it get? There's like a different one for each different adaptation. It is the nerdiest endeavor. It must have been a pandemic project. It's the only possible explanation for how somebody had the time to do this. And what's amazing is they self-published it. I bet it sold 10 copies.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It is like heaven to me. As an Agatha Christie fan, there's a lot of Agatha Christie in the confessions. It's sort of, you know, Liam is a big Agatha Christie fan because I am a big Agatha Christie fan. This book is just heaven for Agatha Christie nerds. So I hope just by mentioning it on this podcast, 10 more copies of it will be sold and we'll double the run. It's called 100%. Agatha Christie, She Watched. Oh, I just seen the subtitle, which I hadn't noticed. One woman's plot to watch 201 Agatha Christie movies without murdering the director, screenwriter, cast, or her husband. So that's my pick of the week and frankly, pick of my entire life.
That is amazing. That is wonderful. All right. So I have nothing so perfectly niche and obscure as either of those. This is painfully mainstream almost, but I don't care. Because I'm really proud of myself because it's relevant current TV. Longer time listeners of the podcast know that I am bad at TV, TM, in that I really like it, but I don't tend to keep up with it very much. So I always kind of have an idea of TV shows that exist that I would like to watch and never actually get around to watching them. In a 3-day binge, my daughter and I, because again, summer, spending a lot of time with each other, watched the whole first season of Murderbot on Apple TV.
Nice.
And it was just a guess on my part that she would like Murderbot because she had once seen me unpacking one of my book bags from school and had seen that I had a copy of Murderbot in it and picked it up and asked me about what the book was about. And I kind of gave her the elevator pitch on it. She said, I think I might want to read that at some point. And my daughter's wheelhouse right now is very much she loves characters who are well-intentioned but extremely awkward and bad at things. Like she wants them to be like extraordinarily competent over in this area, but bad at everything else. That's sort of her official character type that she thinks is delightful. And she also really loves mysteries. She's also a huge sucker for a charming ensemble cast. And I was like, this is going to tick all the boxes because there's a little bit of a mystery thing going on, at least in season one. Absolutely a really good at this and horrible at everything else thing going on with Murderbot itself. And definitely a charming ensemble cast. And so we watched it together. And the first thing she said to me as soon as the credits started rolling on the final episode was, is there going to be another season? Clearly that went over really well. Congratulations to all involved. And I think I spotted Martha Wells's cameo. So
nice.
So not that people needed to be encouraged to watch Murderbot. I suspect they're probably on it well before I was. But if you haven't, as someone who tends to be a bit of a stickler for the whole move from books to film and vice versa, this one's a winner.
It is.
Can I say you have inspired me to do it, because I have been meaning to watch that, because we sell so many of the books in the store.
Yeah.
And I keep forgetting. And you, with that description, and also with painting that picture of, because I think our youngest would love that for all the reasons you just described. You have definitely inspired me to watch it tonight. So
I think it's super worth it. Obviously, there's a few gory bits here and there, but they're not anywhere near as over the top as a lot of things your kid is probably already encountering without you realizing. And although there's some sexual humor that goes on in it, none of it is like lascivious exactly. Yeah. I have no regrets there. And I will say, as someone who's read all the books, like Patrick and like many other folks, it offers a lot in both its fidelity to the original book and also expanding on things that fit in universe and doing things with the television airing format. Since we're able to spend some time outside of Murderbot's head, it gives us some insights into the human members of Preservation Ox that we don't get, at least not in that first book. And those actually are very, very wonderful additions that don't in any way take away from the other sort of structural things that we expect from it. So,
yeah, there's also a couple of points where stuff happens that aren't in that first book, but they happen in such a way that like you believed they could have happened off screen, and you just
this wasn't on Murderbot's radar. Murderbot didn't care about this part
So it was really, really well done for an adaptation. Like, I was very impressed with it.
Yeah. All right. So we do need, alas, to say farewell. But this creates a wonderful opportunity to remind people of where to find you, where to find all your super cool stuff, where to go and pull strings to patronize your store. So, Paul, how can people find you and your cool endeavors in the real world?
Well, they can find my book endeavors at paulbradleycarr.com. Has all that stuff on it. They can find my real endeavors at my shop, which is called The Best Bookstore in Palm Springs, which I hasten to add is the only bookstore in Palm Springs. When we moved here, there wasn't one, and I had ambitions to be a bookseller. But when you move to a town as cool as Palm Springs that has no bookstore, you open a damn bookstore. So it's called The Best Bookstore in Palm Springs. Unfortunately, you can find it by simply Googling or asking your chatbot of choice, where is the best bookstore in Palm Springs? And it has no, unless it's hallucinating, it has no choice but to say it's the best bookstore in Palm Springs.
Nice.
There you go. You outsmarted the algorithm.
Absolutely. It's the first and last time any of us will.
Thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you so much, both of you. Thank you, Patrick. Thanks, Tracy.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of The Functional Nerds. We really appreciate it. If you liked this episode, or really any of our episodes, please consider backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can get access to some cool stuff and help us to keep the lights on. You can also show your support by mentioning us and sharing any of our episodes on your own social channels to help boost the signal. Trust me, that can be huge.
Mr. Carpiers,
you got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions, and then squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay, that's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.